So welcome to session, which is so Brent's got a title, The New Grand Minimum, but I think the original title was Extraterrestrial Influences. So, but I think this carries on from the Extraterrestrial Influences paper. So okay, so we've got about 50 minutes for this session, and Brent has said you can ask questions as he goes through the presentation, so feel free to do that. I just remind people as they ask questions or would like to ask questions, just to raise your hand and then make your way to the microphone. Identify yourself clearly before asking the question as the session is being recorded. So it's certainly interesting to hear or to see an actuary produce a paper like this in the physical sciences. So I found it quite fascinating, as I'm sure that you all did as well. So just by way of introduction to Brent. So Brent has spent over 14 years of managing experience in the life insurance industry, 10 years in the health insurance industry, and 27 years actuarial consulting to the health industry. In this time, he's been involved in advising the Australian Commonwealth and state governments, health insurers, life insurers, friendly societies and retirement villages. He has also undertaken a number of international assignments in Europe and Asia. Brent is a past president of the International Association of Consulting Actuaries. So with that, before I get you up here, Brent, I'll just remind people that we would like the speaker evaluations to be filled in using the 2013 Summit web app. So if you can do that afterwards, and I'll remind you again at the end just to make sure that you do it. And you can also post comments on Twitter using the Summit hashtag. So with all the formalities done, Brent, over to you.
You would all remember the Boxing Day tsunami, killed 250,000 people roughly. It was terrible earthquake that caused that. And these great earthquakes occur, according to the scientists, about every 8 or 10 years. Up until then, I think there'd been 16 or 17 great earthquakes since 1950. And we know that figure is right because the US seeded the world with seismographs then to make sure that any country that developed an atomic bomb, they would know if they'd let one off. So we know that the records are pretty good. The problem with the theory that the great earthquakes only occur about every 7 or 8 years or 10 years or somewhere around about there was that there was another great earthquake in Samoa in 2004. And then in 2005 there were several, in 2006 more, and we've now had 14 great earthquakes since the beginning of 2004. It's about seven times the rate that had occurred between 1950 and 2004. Okay, so that's just a little teaser. I'm going to talk about. Oh, it's not just great earthquakes that interested me. It was also the. I should have mentioned this. The extraordinary floods in Pakistan in 2010. Absolutely fascinating because the monsoon just stopped, and just dropped water and water and water and water on Pakistan. Same time, the Russian wheat crop was completely decimated in the south, the southern part of Russia, and they had bushfires there. How fascinating. The jet streams had literally locked up. Now, why did that happen? And there's lots of events that have occurred since then. One of the things that got me terribly interested was my hometown, the earthquake in Christchurch in 2010, which knocked the old city around a bit. And I was extremely surprised because Christchurch was supposed to be one of the safest places in New Zealand from earthquakes. And then, of course, the February 2011 really knocked the socks off the joint. Okay, I'm going to talk about the new grand minimum. What does it mean? The new grand minimum requires actuaries to evaluate new risks and develop new skills. I'm talking about a whole lot of new data sets here, new things that this profession can do. In a way, as I spoke to the previous session in this room, what I did, I'm sort of repeating what I did in 1974. I joined the HCF, and everybody told me I was crazy and nuts, and, you know, why would you go and work for a health fund when the health insurance business was going to finish in 1975 when Medibank started. But I had other ideas, and I went on a pretty strong research program to develop a new product, which eventually saved the whole industry and eventually enabled actuaries to get into the health insurance business. And now, of course, we have about, I don't know, 30 or 40 actuaries in health insurance. I think that in another 10 or 15 years, we'll have that many working in this area as well, even though you'll be scratching your heads and say, how and why? Now, this is a video from NASA. It's the quiet sun. The Solar Dynamics Observatory has recorded this over 3 years, and it's going to be played in 3 minutes. What we're seeing is the sun with the UV filter on it, so we're only seeing ultraviolet light. And those big bright spots, the sunspots. Back in 2008, the sun was very quiet. It's a little bit more active now, but it won't be for long. One of the things you'll notice is that there seem to be groups, and then there's a bit of a black spot for a while, and then there's some more groups. What has been observed over many years is that there seems to be a 27-day cycle of the sun. Because the sun rotates at the equator every 25 days, and Earth moves around the sun, and it takes 27 days for the same patch of the sun to end up facing Earth again. At minimum, you would think that the sun would be deadly quiet, but it's not. It may be the next solar cycle, which will start in about 2019, 2020. And it will probably die down soon. Here it is in three different, four different filters. It's the UV filter there, it's the ultraviolet there, I'm sure somewhere in between there. And that's just, as we said, white light. You see the little sunspots there, of course. Those bigger ones would be 10, 20, 30 times the size of Earth. Sorry, 1,400,000 kilometres across. As it contains 97% of the matter of the solar system. And it's nearly all plasma. We'll go on from there. This slide is is a graph of the ratio of radiocarbon 14 to the normal carbon atom 12 carbon. And as you'll see, the right-hand scale is reversed, so that during the dips, it's when there is a greater amount of radiocarbon 14 being created, and when there's at the higher points is when there's less. Now, this graph has been distorted in the last 100 years because we're producing far more carbon dioxide. We're burning fossil fuels that have very little, if any, radiocarbon 14 in them, because radiocarbon 14 has a half-life of just 5,730 years. And we're burning fossil fuels that are millions of years old. They laid down millions of years ago, so there's no radiocarbon 14 in there. So what we've done is we've expanded the denominator, but not the numerator, and so that's why that big rise is there. It's not that the world's got hotter. As you can see in this graph, there are a whole bunch of minimums in their last 1,000 years: the Oort, the Wolf, the Spora, the Maunder, and the Dalton minimum. Each one of those would have been regarded as a little ice age. Sometimes we refer to the Spora, Maunder, and Dalton minimums as one little ice age, and other times people refer them separately as little ice ages. But these were grand minimums. As you can see, the Dalton minimum was relatively weak compared to the Maunder minimum, and there are some little squares there, type B and type A, AMPs. That is talking about the angular momentum perturbation on the Sun. In other words, the angular momentum that's been transferred from the planets to the Sun. Now, this happens in all solar systems. All the stars go into grand minimums, and it seems to be from about 10 to about 30% of the time. When I say all stars that have got exoplanets. So any star up there that's got planets whizzing around it will have effects caused by the gravity of the planets on the Sun. It's no different in this solar system. NASA says, this is in a report in January, the Sun could be on the threshold of a mini Maunder event right now. Ongoing solar cycle 24, which is the one we're in now, it's about 11 years, is the weakest in more than 50 years. Moreover, there is controversial evidence of a long-term weakening trend in the magnetic field strength of the sunspots. Matt Penn and William Livingston of the National Solar Observatory predict that by the time solar cycle 25 arrives, magnetic fields on the Sun will be so weak that few, if any, sunspots will be formed. What does this mean for the climate and all sorts of other risks on Earth? NASA has also shown in a report that came out a couple of years ago, one of the NASA reports, that the jet streams below the surface of the Sun. You remember, the surface of the Sun is just the top of the plasma. And, you know, it's nearly all plasma, so it has jet streams, just like Earth has jet streams, because the core of the Sun is revolving faster than the than the atmosphere. It's the same with Earth. You know, the air doesn't completely follow the Earth's rotation. It sort of lags behind, and so we have jet streams to catch it up. Same thing happens on the Sun on a much greater scale. And those jet streams, there's one that's completely missing at the moment. They're not quite sure what that means, but pretty well certain it means that it would be complete, utter grand minimum, certainly starting next cycle. There's a whole bunch of different solar cycles. Some funny names here. The one solar cycle is usually between 8 and 14 years. Why the variation? Well, it's due to the fact that the orbits of Venus, Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn all influence the Sun on its periodical solar cycle. And when they all line up at a certain point, or either in conjunction or opposing each other, then you get a change in the you get at the end of one cycle and the beginning of another. Venus has almost as much influence on the Sun from its gravity as Jupiter. I want to say almost, but about 30% or 40% or something. There's in the middle of each cycle, roughly in the middle, the Sun, the Sun's magnetic poles flip from one hemisphere to the other. So whereas Earth's magnetic poles flip, you know, every million years or something, the Sun's do it every, you know, roughly every 11 years. At this point in the solar cycle, in solar cycle 24, the one we're in now, the North Pole has migrated to the South, but the South Pole has not migrated to the North. The solar side, solar scientists are expecting that it will migrate in the next month or two. The activity in the Sun just these last few weeks has been quite high, which suggests that it's on its way. But we'll wait and see. The so there are cycles 30 years and 60 years relating to Saturn's orbit, 150 to 200 years, which is the periods between grand minimum, and that is due to all of the big gas giants lining up in a particular formation. Saturn's got to be on the other side of the Sun from the other three to cause the grand minimum. Why that is the case, we're not sure. Every roughly 2,400 years, all the planets end up in exactly the same position as they were before, in terms of where they were in the elliptical orbits of the Sun, because none of the planets orbit the Sun in a circular motion. They all have elliptical orbits, not very big ellipses, but obviously they can, you know, they're all going around the Sun at different orbit speeds, so you know, it takes 2,400 years for them all end up in the same place as they were. There's a 27-day cycle as well. This slide is just to give you some perspective about some of the strange concepts of world temperatures, the foundations of climate science, if you like. How can we talk about the temperature of Earth being, you know, a set figure? Water is a huge heat sink. Down the bottom there, you'll see in terms of heat, this is, you know, elementary chemistry, you would have done this at school, hopefully. In terms of heat, to raise the water temperature by 1 degree, if you melt ice at 0 degrees, it takes 80 times the amount of temperature that it takes to raise water temperature by one. You can raise ice by 2 degrees for every 1 degree rise in water temperature for the same amount of heat. And of course it takes 640 times the amount of heat to take water from 0 degrees to boiling point and evaporation. When cold winds are blowing over land, they don't they don't get warmed up much. When they blow really cold winds blow over sea, then the sea moderates it enormously. So climate change in the Northern Hemisphere is a lot different than climate change in the Southern Hemisphere. You can see there at 60 degrees latitude, the Northern Hemisphere has 61% land and the Southern Hemisphere has zero. And at 50 degrees, where there's an awful lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere, they have 28 times more land than what we have in the Southern Hemisphere. And so on, you can see those figures. Okay, I'm going to get a little bit more technical here, but I suggest you read the paper to try and understand some of this. But what I'm going to demonstrate is that the Sun's rays go from infrared, which is the longest wave radiation and gets right through the Earth's surface, turn to the light rays, into the ultraviolet light rays, into extreme ultraviolet light, and then eventually into X-rays. And the X-rays are the shortest of the lot. They're almost, you know, minimal wavelength. The shorter the wavelength, the more energy the photons that that are emitted from the sun have. And this is terribly important in understanding what's going on in the atmosphere when the sun goes quiet. So rather than the sun irradiance varying by about 0.5% from cycle minimum to cycle maximum, point one of a percent from cycle minimum to cycle maximum, you can see that this is a monthly average of the extreme ultraviolet emissions of the sun, and they're varying by, you know, more than four times, in fact far more. The most interesting part about this solar cycle, and of course we haven't seen one since we've had decent space age telescopes up there looking at the sun. So, you know, everybody's sort of scratching their heads and saying, you know, what does this mean? What does this mean? But you can see that solar cycle 24 seems very weak in terms of monthly EUV emissions. We're only at about the same point as about here at this stage. In solar cycle 23, the actual total EUV output is just 60% for the same period of time of the previous solar cycle. That's 23. 23 was weak, quite a weak cycle. And when you adjust for that weakness using some other data which varies similarly to the extreme UV data, you come up with a figure that the extreme ultraviolet emissions of the sun for this cycle compared to the last one that global warming, that when we saw global warming, which was solar cycle 22, it ended in 1996, it's just 40%. Okay, so what do EUV emissions do? Well, they are the ones that provide the energy to split oxygen atoms in the atmosphere, and then those oxygen atoms recombine with other oxygen atoms, or three nitrogen oxides, to become ozone. So they're directly responsible for producing the ozone layer. At the time when they do that, they also produce heat. And this graph here, I'm not sure how well you can see it, but it is a sort of a pictorial of the atmosphere. On the right-hand side of that graph, you'll see that the troposphere, this is the part that we live in, up to the first 10 kilometres, up to 10,000 metres, contains 76% of the total atmosphere of Earth. The next 40 kilometres contain another almost 20%. The next, whatever it is, nearly 400-odd kilometres, contain less than 4%, and then the little bits above that, very little indeed. Sorry, not that. The mesosphere contains 4%, and the thermosphere, very, very little indeed. So when you hear about these funny sphere terms, bear in mind, you know, even though they seem to be very big, you know, they seem to have cover a lot of height, they don't have very much going. There's not much going on in them. Satellites normally cruise around about this, about here. That's where a lot of satellites are. 2 years ago, not even 2 years ago, I think it was, yes, two years ago, at a space science conference in Germany, I think it was, one of the NASA solar physicists advised that the thermosphere had collapsed by something like 70%, I think it was. And the temperature of it had gone down by 100 degrees. And that was all due to the fact that the sun was quiet. It's pumped up a bit now, but it's expected to go much quieter than that later. And this is one of the conditions that's going to occur over the next next solar cycle, maybe two. It's going to influence all sorts of other risks. I think this slide is probably just a little bit too hard for people to understand, but the point that I'm trying to make is that the sun is ejecting protons and electrons all the time. And they come to Earth on the solar wind. And every now and again, it has a sun flare in one of the big sunspots. And if the flare is big enough, it can actually penetrate Earth's atmosphere. Normally, the protons and electrons don't make it through the sun's magnetic field. But occasionally they do. And I'm going to talk about, first of all, the strength of the sun's magnetic field. And then I'm going to give you a little bit later on an example of what happened back in March this year, which is absolutely fascinating. As you can see, the sun's magnetic field is, this is the current cycle. That's cycle 23, 22, 21. So you can see 21 and 22 there seems to be a lot of magnetic strength, and cycle 23 not nearly as much, but the magnetic strength was not synchronized with the sunspot activity. It came after the sunspot activity, which is fascinating. And then in this cycle, you can see the magnetic strength is quite low. There was just one peak. Back last year, I think it was last year, and it's been quite low since. It's probably beefed up this last month. The average magnetic strength for this cycle is just 66% of cycle 23 and 55% of cycle 21. And it was at the end of cycle 21 that global warming stopped. The ratio of the highest to lowest monthly average is 31, and if you look at the actual data, the magnetic strength of the sun goes from zero to, you know, big numbers. So it varies enormously from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute. There is a link between the jet streams in the sun. Normally there are two wave-like jet streams in each hemisphere at approximately the boundary of the troposphere and the stratosphere. Now the troposphere normally goes to about 6 kilometres at the poles, 6 kilometres above ground, above sea level, and about 14 to 16 kilometres above sea level at the equator. On that previous graph, I showed it just at 10, because that's the average, but it's it varies. And the other, the stratosphere's got similar variation as have the others, saying that they're not constant, you can't go, from 1 kilometre to the next, and I'm out of the stratosphere and I'm into the mesosphere or something or other. It doesn't work that way. So there are normally two jet streams. One's closer to the poles, and usually it's around about 7,000 metres, and the other one is closer to the equator, and it's usually up around about 14,000 metres. With strong cycles, they gradually move towards the poles, and I think it's because the stratosphere gets warmer, and so the jet stream tends to rise. And with weak cycles, they generally move out towards the equator. There was a lot of quite a lot of papers that were produced at the IPCC in around the 1980s, 1990s, and even into the early 2000s, pointing out the catastrophes that were going to occur because the jet streams were moving towards the poles. And from those, scientists were saying, we'll have continual droughts in Australia, and we need to build desalination plants because, it's never going to rain again, and they'll never see snow in England anymore, and all of those things. And of course, it all turned around. Now, I'm going to introduce another physical phenomenon. It's called the polar vortex. This has a significant effect on the jet streams. This graph was produced by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of the US. It's on their website somewhere. And it explains how the polar vortex, what happens when the polar vortex changes. When the stratosphere is very cold, the vortex is strong. That's what I said, cold in relation to the air around it. The vortex is very strong. You get storms coming up from the south to England, and it's warm and wet over Europe and dry in the Mediterranean. When the stratosphere is much warmer relative to the air around it, then the polar vortex gets weak, can even turn right round and go back the other way. It can go from east to west. And cold air then sweeps down over Europe and the UK and North America, and much weaker trade winds and the stormy weather, wetter weather, gets closer to the Mediterranean, even further south than that. Now, this is exactly what happened in March. In March 15, there was a sunspot 1692, and it produced an M-class flare, which is not a particularly big one, but it did last quite a while, about 36 minutes. The sunspot was directly facing Earth. It was right in the centre of the solar disk at the time that it happened, and it chucked billions of tons of plasma earthward, but of course it all spreads out and goes all around space, but there's enough of it coming directly at Earth. On March 17, that sunspot hit Earth's magnetic field. Now, normally that wouldn't mean much. We'd just get a few auroras and that would be it. And for a short time, the magnetic field line of Earth, this is a magnetic field line of Earth and a magnetic field line of the Sun, joined. I'm going to show you a video of this in a second. And when they joined, they channeled tons of, maybe even hundreds of tons of plasma into the upper atmosphere. That migrated to the North Pole. The North Pole then, the ionosphere above the North Pole and the stratosphere actually, increased in temperature by about 60 degrees. That stopped the polar vortex going clockwise, and going anticlockwise, and started going clockwise. The Arctic Oscillation, which is a measure of how the polar vortex is effectively working compared to average, it went so deeply negative that I hadn't seen it like that before, but it turns out it had been like that, but not very often. And over the next few weeks, the polar jet stream completely disappeared, virtually, and the North Pole got much warmer as cold polar air went south, and this warm air from the stratosphere sunk down onto the pole. So you would have read in the paper, the North Pole's heating up, poor old polar bears, but it occurred simply because of a magnetic, huge sunspot flare. One of the most worrying things about this was that a strong high-pressure system formed over Greenland. It was the highest pressure ever recorded there, and that was thought by Russian scientists to have destabilised the New Madrid and San Andreas fault lines, because above both of those fault lines there was a lot of activity in the ionosphere. And it was similar activity to what occurred in the ionosphere before the Sendai earthquake. So much so that the Russians told their fleet to get the hell out of there, get well away, because if the San Andreas fault line had ruptured badly, then it would have created a big tsunami in the Pacific. So it was just interesting. You don't hear these things. You know, the newspapers don't print these things because bad news is not good news, I guess. This is a picture of that this exact flare. It's been shown three times, but it's 30 seconds, 3 days and 30 seconds, if you like. This is the Arctic Oscillation. Now, as I said, it's a measure sort of when it's positive, it means the polar vortex is going probably more strongly than usual by that time of the year, and when it's negative, it means it's going less strongly. There were some solar flares around about here early in March, which pushed it down a bit, but they didn't make the magnetic connection with Earth in the same way. And the reason why I believe they didn't, the magnetic field lines didn't connect, was that after this solar flare on March 15, the sun went quiet for a couple of days, 3 days, and there was zero magnetic field strength on the day that the sunspot hit. And so that meant that the field line of the sun was incredibly weak, and that's why it linked up with the Earth's magnetic field line. As you can see, it went very low. There's been four times in the last 50 years that the sun has had the Arctic Oscillation has been that negative for that long, for 3 days or more, below five for 3 days. Two of them occurred in solar cycle 20, about 1969 and 1970, I think it was. In the first half of the cycle, that's when the sunspots are most active. And we've had three now in this cycle, where it's gone below five. Very interesting. Now, the reason why I talked about this is because after that, they had incredibly cold, snowy weather right across Europe. You know, rivers froze, all sorts of things happened. The Baltic Sea had lots of ice in it. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things happened, and the same in the US. And even last Wednesday, they had snow in Devon in the UK. Crazy. It's still snowing in parts of the US as well. And Canada's got all sorts of diabolical trouble trying to get their grain crops to grow because it's just been too cold. So that one CME has caused a lot of angst amongst farmers, and of course there was a lot of people who died. 6,000 excess deaths were recorded in the UK in March alone, over what they expected. So that's not a small number. I mean, it's equivalent to about 3,000 excess deaths in 1 month in Australia. I think if that happened in Australia, we'd be all jumping up and down and saying, what the hell's going on? This is a depiction by NASA of how this particular coronal mass ejection linked up with Earth's magnetic field lines and then ended up in the North Pole. Some of it is, they've superimposed the magnetic field lines on there, but the aurora has actually been filmed from space. So that's the actual aurora that occurred on the 17th, 18th and 19th of March. Okay, these are pictures of the jet streams. Now, I'm sorry, they look terribly messy, I would have loved to have been able to give you jet streams at 200 millibars instead of 300. So 200 is really the core, but there is no there's no recording that I know of that's available at the 200 millibars. So I had to make do with the 300. These come from a website in the United States, a Californian climate website. And they show, first of all, the pole at the date the sunspot occurred, the coronal mass ejection occurred. You can see jet streams all over the place close to the pole. 5 days later, the jet streams around the close to the pole seem to have got quite a lot less. Even less, more by the 25th of March. 30th of March, there's nothing left there at all. The jet stream's pretty well completely gone, the one that was close to the pole. And there's still not much there on the 4th of April and even the 9th of April. Even by the 19th of April, there's still very, very little of the polar jet stream protecting Europe, because it keeps the cold air from the pole bottled up at the pole rather than allowing it to spread over the northern hemisphere. As I said, since 1950 there have been four other occasions, two in the ramp-up part of solar cycle 20 and two in solar cycle 24. Now, solar cycle 20 occurred in the late 60s through to about the end of 1970, and you might remember that there was an awful lot of scare talk about the reduction in the ozone layer and the big hole in the ozone layer over the southern hemisphere, and how we're all going to get fried and get cancer and everything because of it, and it was our evil use of CFCs. Well, that was partially correct. Certainly the CFCs helped, but the very weak solar cycle played a major part in the reduction of the amount of ozone in the atmosphere at that time. This time we're not hearing very much about it because the hole in the ozone layer is now in the northern hemisphere as well as the southern hemisphere in spring. And I don't think I've got it in the presentation, but if you read the paper, you'll actually be able to understand how the CFCs and other emissions and ozone interact in spring at the pole and cause the ozone to break up back into oxygen. And so another example of a coronal mass ejection was in January 28 last year. This was a bigger flare. The 8.7 flare is much bigger than the one we had, the 3.2 that we had this year. And it sent plasma at 2,250 kilometres per second to Earth. The one we had this year was only about 1,500 kilometres per second to Earth. It hit Earth tangentially on January the 24th. And the Arctic Oscillation went from minus 1.77 to minus 3.45. In other words, it doubled, if you like. The jet streams were affected enough to cause a wave of frigid air to flood Eastern Europe, the Balkans, Italy and Greece. And for about a month, it was damn cold there. The Danube froze over over much of its length, over 2,000 kilometres. The Sea of Azov partially froze over. They couldn't run boats down the Danube, or they couldn't use the Sea of Azov, which is the entrance to the Black Sea. Parts of Europe really froze. There was, something like 40 feet of snow in parts of Romania and places. It was quite an amazing thing. I don't know how many people died, but because there was never any reports that came out of the Balkans that told us, but there would have been thousands. So by now I would have probably
made you think, oh gosh, we have to be careful about the sun, but this because it can cause many ice age conditions. But the Arctic stratosphere can warm for a number of reasons. It can warm for the reason that I've just talked about, the impact of plasma from a CME. It can also warm from the stratospheric volcanic eruptions. And during the Maunder minimum, sorry, not the Maunder minimum, the Dalton minimum, there were three major volcanic eruptions. I'll talk about them in a minute. And during the Maunder minimum, there was lots of them, but they weren't quite as big. We've got to wind it up, okay. And there's other reasons why Arctic stratosphere can warm up. I've talked about Pakistan floods and the Russian wheat belt drought. Cyclone Sandy was caused by a locked jet stream. The heat wave that we had in Australia in December last year and January this year was caused by a locked jet stream. It was up the east coast of Australia and it just stopped the high pressure systems moving across Australia and just bottled them up so that it just got hotter and hotter and hotter in there. That locked jet stream eventually worked its way to the other side of New Zealand, probably about 800 or 1,000 kilometres off the east coast of New Zealand, and it stayed there for ages, months. And New Zealand had, they call it the best summer ever, but the grass was blowing off the paddocks in the North Island. There was hardly a sheep to be seen when I was over there in March. And the whole of the North Island was had a total fire ban. Shows you how bad it was in New Zealand. A little bit about the great earthquakes. You can see the great earthquakes seem to mainly occur during sunspot minimum, which is something even I didn't expect that. And from 2004, you can see there's been this enormous number. And that is due, you'll have to read both papers to understand that exactly, but that is due to the basically the gravitational effects of all the planets lining up on the tectonic plates of Earth, and it just makes them move a little bit faster. And through the tidal forcing causes extra heat low down in the magma. In the Dalton minimum, there was a undocumented volcanic eruption in 1809. This is known from polar ice cores, both North Pole and South Pole. We don't know where it was, possibly near Vanuatu, but we don't know. No one knows. Then there was Laki in 1783-84. That killed 20% of the Iceland population and tens of thousands in Europe. In Tambora, 71,000 direct deaths in Indonesia and hundreds of thousands elsewhere in the world. The 1809 one and the 1815 one gave us the coldest decade in 500 years on Earth. And crop failures everywhere during that time. I think, I can't remember which year it was, but 45 million people died in China from drought. For the new grand minimum, I think there's been more volcanic activity than normal. But who can tell? Because there just aren't good records, so we just don't know. They're too poor for comparison. But there certainly seems to be a lot going on at the present time. I think there's a very good chance, almost 100% chance, there will be a big volcanic eruption during this grand minimum. And then we're going to find some major problems with feeding the world's population. The Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations is extremely worried about these things. So what can we expect? Far more variable weather due to erratic changes in the jet streams. Cold waves, heat waves, storms, droughts, storm monsoons, all those sorts of things. Loss of crops. In the southern hemisphere, we'll get colder winters and hotter summers. Droughts, significant rain events. The Dalton minimum occurred when Sydney was first settled by Europeans.
I'll give you the history of the Hawkesbury River. March 1799, it was a 50-foot flood at Windsor. 1800, a 40-foot flood. 1806, this is all in March, 48 feet. Now, they had to evacuate Windsor and build it on a different place. May 1809 and August 1809, there was two 48-foot floods. June 1816, another major one. February 1817, February 1819 and June 1819. All major floods on the Hawkesbury River. Now, if the Hawkesbury floods that much, admittedly we won't get that now because the Warragamba Dam's there, but the Warragamba Dam fills up. And we, as we know from the flooding we've had last summer, they had to let plenty of water out of it. But it probably means that the whole of the east coast of Australia is copping some major wet events. The risks that we have then for the profession is, have we estimated the natural disaster risks? I've got to stop, don't I?
Yeah, you've got the next ordinance.
Yeah, they're all coming in. We've got all sorts of actuarial risks that we ought to think about. And anyway, they're up there on the thing. The one that worries me most is our reputation. Have we got our forecasting right? And I don't believe we're anywhere near right at the present time. It's the end.